At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Six American helicopters now down in 3 weeks in Iraq. 27 Americans dead falling from the sky. The latest yesterday, a big twin-rotor Marine Sea Knight transport helicopter crashing in a field northwest of Baghdad in billowing flames and smoke. In a war of many fronts and factors, with a largely street-level security surge now gearing up in Baghdad, helicopters are just one front. But if you're an American soldier or civilian trying to get around in Iraq or get close air support, they've been critical. Now, with bombs on the roads and fire in the sky, it's a tough picture. From Somalia to Afghanistan, Americans have learned to pay attention when choppers rain down. Up next on Point, Black Hawk and more down in Iraq. Joining me first today from Baghdad, where two helicopter crashes have been reported in the last 24 hours, is Louise Rogue, Baghdad correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Louise, thanks for being with us. Are people paying attention there to what's going on with the choppers?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think people are paying a lot of attention. The U.S. military here is trying to figure out whether there's more than just numbers at play, whether this is more than a statistical fluke. So far, we're talking about as many as six helicopters in the last 3 weeks. And for the military, who are so reliant on the helicopters, this is a big problem.
Tell us about the big one that went down yesterday northwest of Baghdad, a Sea Knight. It could carry 24. Thankfully, only seven on board, all dead. What's the latest on how and why it came down?
Well, witnesses told us that the helicopter went down after shots had been fired, and they described a loud crash and the helicopter swinging wildly in the sky before careening downwards and crashing in flames. Several witnesses described that. There are some conflicting accounts from the military, accounts that this was actually a mechanical error. So it's unclear as yet whether it was actually shut down or whether it was a mechanical failure.
But there have been confirmed shoot downs, most of these, of the six in the last 3 weeks, and eyewitness reports saying it may have been the case again yesterday. It's not as though the U.S. military is denying that they've got choppers being shot down in general, are they?
Indeed. And what's really interesting is that the helicopters that have been shut down, the military attributed to small arms fire rather than missiles. So fairly unsophisticated weapons, something that's in the hands of, many thousand people here. So it could be a big problem.
Louise, we've seen for years now how tough it can be to work on the roads in Iraq with the IEDs, the explosive devices lining so many roads. Remind us of all the functions that choppers are used for in the Iraq battle zone, all over Iraq. How are they deployed and used?
Well, the military has logged more than 1 million man-hours in helicopters since the war began in 2003. And that includes combat missions, but it also includes logistics, bringing supplies to and from bases. It includes medical missions. And in terms of just air support, the military has become more reliant on having air support when they go out and patrol on the ground. So there's been more use of helicopters as the war has progressed and as we enter here the fourth year of the conflict, rather than less.
The surge is supposed to be gearing up in Baghdad right now with a lot more U.S. soldiers on the streets there. When they go out on patrol, are helicopters part of the formula? Are they flying close support in the kind of patrols that will be part of the surge?
Well, indeed, in the 2 years that I have been here, 2 years ago, if American soldiers went on patrol in Baghdad, for example, they wouldn't necessarily have air support. Now, almost 9 out of 10 times, they will have air support. And it's a big advantage for the military, of course, to be able to have what they call eyes in the sky to see what's going on the ground. And so, yeah, you're just seeing more use of helicopters. With the surge, so far we've only got 3,000 of the 21,000 expected troops in Baghdad already. But as the surge comes underway and as people are being brought in, again, we're going to be more reliant on air support and helicopter missions.
And what about just the day-in and day-out operations? I mean, can the U.S. military function as it has if helicopters become so vulnerable, if we have this rate of shoot-down?
Well, there's no doubt that the military is enormously dependent on helicopters. And it's hard to see how they could pull off all these operations without the helicopter support. I mean, helicopters just within Baghdad fly between various bases, and for soldiers it's almost like going down and taking the bus. I mean, they jump on a Black Hawk and it'll fly 5 minutes to go to another base, but those 5 minutes, that's an alternative to traveling on roads that are simply so unsafe now.
Louise Rogue in Baghdad, please stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Monterey, California, retired Army Special Forces Colonel Caleb Sepp. He's professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Caleb Sepp, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
Helicopters go down in war. In Vietnam, we lost 3,000. Even so, this is quite a rash in just a short amount of time. What do you make of it?
It's really too soon to tell, but it could signal a change in the collective tactics of the enemies that we're fighting. Over time, their attempts to inflict casualties on the coalition forces, the American forces in particular, through the use of the improvised explosive devices, mm-hmm. the roadside bombs, has been countered by the Americans through tactics, through better armored vehicles, through equipping soldiers with better body armor. So the question would then become, where else are the Americans vulnerable? And exactly as Louise was reporting from Baghdad, the helicopter fleet is someplace that they can attack, and when successful, can create spectacular results with very high American casualties.
We had Marine General Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, saying earlier this week, "I do not know whether or not it's the law of averages that caught up with us in this rash of helicopter downings." How vulnerable are these choppers, Caleb Sepp?
In some ways it's very difficult to shoot down a military helicopter, particularly the generation of helicopters that are being flown in Iraq right now. They were developed later in the Cold War very specifically to survive the extremely lethal environment that was anticipated would result from combat with the Soviet forces in Europe, because the Russian army then and to some degree continues today to have very, very effective anti-aircraft defenses. And so more armor was placed in the helicopters, our helicopters around critical components around the pilots and aircrew themselves, and redundant systems were placed in. But it still has to be, we have to weigh against the issue of the helicopter still has to fly, so we can't quite make it a flying tank.
And who might be shooting these down? Would this be Sunnis? Would it be Shia? Is it everybody firing on Americans now?
Oh, that's Tom, you're back to the question about, what kind of war we're fighting, and is it an insurgency or so? Well, of course, the answer is it's both those things. We're resented by Sunni and Shia extremists because we're getting in the way of them inflicting genocide on each other. The Sunni resistance is still fighting against us. And then there's the jihadis that are, of course, come into the country that want to, in a particularly bloody way, want to count coup against the Americans. So shooting down American helicopters provides great internet copy for them and the video clips that they post.
And it's up there already. YouTube has got, you plug in Iraq helicopter down, and there it is with the Arabic chanted in the background and the ball of flame.
Exactly right. But the question is how are they getting better at doing this? And that would raise the point that that it's just casual firing of a weapon into the air directly at a helicopter actually very rarely produces results. You really have to train people where they have to aim, You have to teach them to concentrate fires. There's some real military training involved with this.
Does that mean the hand of Iran, or might that be claimed, or do we just have that much expertise in Iraq itself?
There's some of that would have been resident in the old Iraqi army, in the leader in some of the tactical leadership among the officers. But the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has had advisors in Afghanistan during our expedition there, fighting against their enemy, the Taliban. And the same Revolutionary Guard Corps advisors have been spotted in Iraq over the last several years. This is all open source. There's nothing classified about this.
Luis Rogue, in Baghdad, do you sense a reluctance of people to get up in the air in a helicopter these days to get around, or do they have any choice but to go up and use the choppers?
Well, I don't think people have much of a choice here. I mean, it kind of has to be done, and so the soldiers sort of get on with their job. The other thing is that, as we've seen, it's not just military helicopters flying increasing numbers of missions here. It's also private security companies like Blackwater who fly in support of, for example, State Department employees, et cetera. So they're logging more flying hours as well, and they fly typically lower and in smaller aircraft than what the military employ.
William's calling right now from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, thanks for having me.
What do you know, William?
Well, I know a fair amount. I could probably join the discussion a little bit. I think the principal problem is that we have very limited intelligence on the enemy, and we are flying in a flight profile very low to the ground, not necessarily what's called super NOE in the folds of the earth, which mass you normally from the ground fire and the SA-7s and SA-9s. You've got to get very, very low, but the terrain and particularly in Iraq is very flat, not very hilly. So most of the time the aircraft are going to be exposed. If they fly too low, and as they are doing now, to stay out of SA-7, SA-9 range, then, of course, they're very vulnerable to small arms fire. And, of course, the enemy is very amorphous all over the place. Intel is bad, so it's going to be very hard to figure this thing out.
William, you sound like you know your stuff. What's your experience with these aircraft?
I have flown basically all the aircraft that are there now, minus the H-64.
In what service, in what environment?
Army. And I flew it not in a wartime environment. I was actually in the Pentagon for the first war. So, but I have some good background in tactics, techniques, and procedures.
So Black Hawk, Apache, you know these. You've been up in these. What are you told about the kind of small arms fire that's being, we're told, trained in great volume on these aircraft? Can they withstand it?
Well, sure. If they mask their fires with small arms fire and they're within range, they can do a lot of damage. Now, there are self-sealing tanks on all of these aircraft that will take up to and including, I think, a 12.7 round. It depends on the aircraft. Some will say even 23 millimeter, I think, maybe even on the Chinook. But all of them have self-sealing tanks and breakaway tanks, so when they do crash, hopefully there isn't a post-crash fire. The small arms fire, though, can get into small operating systems, rotor issues, the drivetrain back to the tail rotor itself, and those types. Of course, with the large tandem rotored aircraft like the CH-46 from the Marines or the CH-47 from the Army, you have two of these counter-rotating tandem huge rotors. They're going to be very hard to take down shooting them, but if you shoot a portion of, let's say, the transmission or combining transmission or something like that, it'll certainly bring the aircraft down.
William, stick with us for a second here. I want to bring one more voice in from Washington. We're joined by Robert Work. He's Vice President, Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, 20-year veteran of the Marine Corps. Robert Work, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. We've got a pilot on the line with us with a lot of experience here in the Army with choppers saying Iraq is awfully difficult. You can't get down, as he says, in the folds of the earth. You're exposed. Do we have to have choppers giving close support down in small arms fire range to do the kind of things that President Bush is talking about doing in Baghdad in the next few months?
Well, I think yes. U.S. forces have used helicopters, as Luis said at the top of the story, for a wide variety of things. Battlefield mobility, just moving people from point to point on the battlefield. Battlefield logistics, moving supplies. Medevacs, taking out casualties and getting them to the hospital within that golden hour to save them. Fire support, combat search and rescue of downed helos. soft raids, and then the big, most difficult type of job, air assault, where you're actually dropping in a major unit on an enemy concentration or near him.
So, so six down in 3 weeks. Does it crimp those operations, or just simply make them more vulnerable?
I agree with Caleb, that it's too early to tell, but I disagree with him and tend to agree more with William. I think that they're very complex machines. They're easy to shoot down if they are get within an range of the enemy's fires. And it's all a matter of tactics. You try to avoid enemy concentrations on your flight in and out, and you try to land where the enemy isn't. If the enemy really thinks about where you might land or can guess where you might go and can mass his forces, then the helicopters are very vulnerable. So it's too early to tell if this is just the law of averages. Remember what Louis said, a million man hours in this war. The total number of helicopter losses to this point, based on the total number of hours we've flown, has been relatively low. But this last surge, if it becomes an indication that the enemy has changed their tactics, it could have a major impact on the way the U.S. forces operate.
William, in Charleston, you're the pilot. Do you have a bag of tricks and tactics that you think could help you survive in the situation, or is the vulnerability just baked in the cake there?
Well, I think, as I said before, if the intelligence isn't very good, you can't avoid where they are all the time. In the old days, of course, you had intelligence reports would tell you where the mass concentrations were of these folks, and you would plan your routes so you wouldn't fly over them or near them. In a combat assault, what he's talking about are basically, in the old days, Hueys going in with Cobra gunships riding on their flanks as support. Now, I assume we're talking Blackhawks and maybe some follow-on Chinooks, at least in Iraq, as the assault ships, and then have some sort of gun support, either some Cobras from the Marines or, in the case of the Army, it would probably be nothing but AH-64 gunships, but at least something there to suppress fires if they do fly into a hot LZ.
William, we appreciate your voice of experience. Thanks for calling in. Let me get another experienced caller from Portland, Maine. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I just came back from a year in Southwest Asia serving with the Army, and I did a fair amount of flight ops.
By Southwest Asia, you mean Iraq. Okay, yeah.
Yes, I was also in Afghanistan, but the experience I'm going to draw from right now is from Iraq. And I have to admit, there's a real pucker factor when you're flying over neighborhoods in Baghdad low to the ground, and you can look down and see these bombed-out areas.
Pucker as in fear.
Yes, and there were many days when I anticipated somebody popping up on a roof and taking some shots at us. Unfortunately, that never happened. But I can say this, that I was extremely impressed with the capabilities of our pilots and our crew chiefs, and I felt the most confidence in their abilities to get us through what we needed to do. But I just want to make this comment.
Yes.
Don't underestimate the intelligence of the enemy in terms of sensing our lack of political will in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And however tragic it is when Americans lose their life, the enemy knows that we really don't have the political will to see this enterprise through.
So do you see helicopters targeted as part of an effort to demoralize the American public back home with those images?
Yes, one of many efforts, but it's certainly one prong of their effort, yes.
Let me ask you, though, very materially then, away from propaganda, just at the operations point, can we do what is on the drawing board in the security surge in Baghdad? Can we carry that out if choppers are coming down at this rate? Can we give the troops on the ground the support they need, David?
Well, that answer is outside of my pay grade, but I can say this, that we're going to have to stick with some basic tactical decisions and techniques that have been used overall and for the most part have proved effective. But again, it's a matter of political will, and the enemy senses that we don't have the political will in this country right now.
We're trying to balance all of that right here. We appreciate your call, David, and your service. Caleb Sepp, there's a complicated formula here about capacity to function as the military would like to on the ground in Baghdad, and then far above that, this kind of propaganda war that's going on. Let's go to the functional piece first. Do you think that the surge can work day by day if choppers are vulnerable, or can they get air support from higher up in the sky?
Great question, Tom. But as has been described publicly at a number of different levels, the surge the operations in Baghdad to secure Baghdad are not reliant on helicopter support. Fire support is is critical, you know, for our troops when they get into a tough fight, and that is provided primarily by the Apache helicopter gunship, because it's precision fire as opposed to artillery fire or mortar fire, which is frankly more random and causes much more collateral damage. But for those Apaches to be able to engage targets very, very precisely, they have to hover, stop and hover, and they make themselves targets at that point.
But I want to understand, you said the security operations are not reliant on choppers, but do they need the Apaches then, hovering low or not?
It's useful, but the neighborhoods that they're moving into right now, most of the fighting that would have to be done would want to minimize the use of firepower, because they're, as the president himself said in his strategy, the lead consideration of what they're doing is protecting the population, as opposed to what they did in Fallujah in 2004, where they fought their way through the city and caused terrific destruction. The idea is not to gut Baghdad to secure it.
Luis Rogue, you're there on the ground. What are the skies like over Baghdad? Is it a nonstop kind of helicopter traffic pattern? Is the sound of rotor blades always in the air there?
Well, yes, I would say the sound of helicopters is fairly constant here. You know, we live outside the green zone, but fairly close to the green zone, and so we're sort of in their traffic pattern. That is sort of a constant.
And the pucker factor that our caller talked about, do you hear the military talking about, Lord, I've got to go up in a chopper and go somewhere? Is the fear factor there?
Well, as I mentioned, I think they know what they're here for, and, you know, they're getting on with the job. I mean, I haven't encountered fear as such. I mean, of course, there's concern, in this, especially, you know, days after something, you know, a big helicopter goes down, there's some concern. But I think, you know, they're professionals and they get on with the job.
Luis Rogue with the Los Angeles Times in Baghdad, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks.
Robert Work, what's your take on the operations side of this? If we continue, if it's not just an accident of statistics, if we should continue to see choppers coming down at this rate, how does it impact American operations on the ground?
Well, it could have a huge impact. During the 1980s, the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan, and the Americans essentially armed the Mujahideen with shoulder-fired what are called man pads, man-portable air defense systems, what William was referring to as SA-7s. That's a Soviet-style man pads, which is a very small rocket you fire from your shoulder, short range, but very deadly to helicopters. And that changed the entire complexion of the war. So that is why I think that the coalition forces are being very careful about what they say. What exactly does this mean? Is it just a temporary, is it due to the number of helicopters that are in the sky because of the surge and therefore more are vulnerable to what is called AAA, anti-aircraft fire, unguided weapons? Or is it the introduction of more of these guided missiles, which would really change the way the U.S. handles it? I agree with Caleb that you don't need the helicopters to do the surge, but without the helicopters, the surge becomes much more difficult. Just delivering logistics to the patrol bases that are going to be dotted around Baghdad, taking out casualties by helicopter, providing fire support. If the insurgents are able to push helicopters over the sky in Baghdad, it will certainly make the job of the American soldiers and Marines much more difficult.
Tough picture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Caleb Sepp, the storyline that we all learned out of Afghanistan was, Stinger missiles came in with some American support, Soviet helicopters came down, and pretty soon the Soviets were on their way out. I'm sure that's an oversimplified picture, but the public has learned, and again in Mogadishu and Somalia, that when choppers come down, it can emerge being seen as having a real strategic impact. So, same situation in Iraq, or is it too simple a reading of those earlier conflicts?
The Robert is exactly right in the way that he described the infusion of the man pads, these shoulder fired anti aircraft missiles into Afghanistan. But exactly as you're saying, Tom, it was actually more complex than that. The genius behind the effort in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan war to deny the Soviets freedom of the skies was Mike Vickers, the famous junior Central Intelligence Agency officer, who came in and proposed the program, the campaign to defeat the Soviet helicopter fleet in Afghanistan. And it involved more than just the anti-aircraft missiles. It was to deny them ability to move their helicopters at all altitudes and in all operating environments by training the Afghan Mujahideen in anti-aircraft techniques with small arms, and then equipping them with the light machine guns, heavy machine guns, even anti-aircraft cannon, as well as the anti-aircraft missiles. And the Soviets suddenly found themselves unsafe at any altitude.
So what does it mean when they come down, when they're shot down? What does it mean on the ground? Can it be one lucky shot from a kid with a rifle in a window, or does this have to be a barrage, Caleb Sepp, of, I don't know, dozens, scores, more of small arms aimed up at the sky? Or are we talking about just one sophisticated weapon bringing choppers down?
Well, this is exactly what Robert was talking about before, the advantage of the shoulder-fired missile, because it has an infrared heat-seeking warhead, should mean that you fire a single missile and you get, you know, one missile gets one helicopter. But if you're using small arms, the general technique is to fire as much as possible into the air in a coordinated way. And you can do this not just with rifle fire, but what brought down in the famous Black Hawk Down fight in Mogadishu in 1993, what brought down our helicopters there were barrages of the rocket-propelled grenades, which have a very short range of only a few hundred meters. But the Somalis had figured out our pattern of flight operations and had rehearsed firing these rockets in barrages. And again, most of them missed, but it only took one out of the barrage that fired to take the helicopter down.
And Robert Work, you're saying more barrage than sophisticated weapon attack here.
Well, in urban terrain, barrages of small arm fires are very effective in barrages of RPGs. If you remember during Operation Iraqi Freedom, the major combat phase, there was a regiment of AH-64 Apaches. These are the toughest helicopters we have. They're specifically designed for close support of troops. They're armored. They have titanium bathtubs. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of things on the planes. Mm-hmm. But about 30 of them went out one day, and they flew over an urban concentration where people just essentially shot their weapons into the sky, shot down one, and 29, I think, of 30 or 30 of 31 had to come back and could not fly because of battle damage.
Earlier this week, before the fifth helicopter went down in Iraq, Major General William Caldwell addressed what the military is doing to prevent shootdowns.
We are already making adjustments in our tactics and techniques and procedures as to how we employ our helicopters in support of Iraqi security forces and coalition forces.
Adjustments on the way, but there's a lot of work to be done and vulnerable American troops in the process. Caleb Sepp is with us today from Monterey, California. He's a retired Army Special Forces Colonel, professor of defense analysis at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. From Washington, we're joined by Robert Work, 27-year Marine Corps veteran. He's vice president of strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, giving us a close eye on these choppers coming down. Right now, Lawrence is calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Lawrence, you're on the air.
Good morning, Tom. I'm a former Air Force colonel. I've been in, I have not flown in Iraq with helicopters. I'm a Air Force pilot.
So how do you see what's going on there? How does it strike you?
I see this as a continuation of a problem since that began in Korea and is still with us, as service rivalries playing a role here. There's an aircraft called the A-10 in the Air Force inventory that's not being employed properly in Iraq today over those helicopters and over those troops.
Why not?
I'm not sure, but my sense is that the rivalry that exists, the Army, I date back with this with the Battle of Ap Bak in Vietnam in January of 1963.
A-10's a big gunship, right?
Right, and so what happens is an A-10 has the ability to take a look for these people. If the helicopter's low to the ground, they can be heard coming, and you know, they don't have good visibility. If they're flying at 1,500 feet, they're an open target. And so if you have the A-10 above them, it'll suppress fire much more quickly, much more rapidly. and be much more safer. And the decision here, with all due respect to your previous guest,
yes,
they haven't addressed this issue. And, you know, it happened in Mogadishu with the sending of the gunship home. But if you look at what the A-10 has done in the early part of this war in Iraq, and in the previous war, in the Gulf War, and when it's used properly in Afghanistan, the suppression of fire is much more effective.
You're saying it could really help. Lawrence, stand by. Let me go to Robert Work. Lawrence sees perhaps service rivalry here. Why not the A-10? Of course, you know, you bring it in and it lays down an awful lot of fire, maybe more than they want to lay down in Baghdad with the civilian concerns that we're talking about today. But do you see service rivalry here, Robert Work?
No, not really. I believe Lawrence is exactly correct. For certain fire support missions, the A-10 is a superb platform. I would be very surprised if they aren't in orbits over Baghdad right now. And generally what they would do is if a unit was in contact with the enemy and needed air support, they would call in a precise coordinate, and the A-10 most normally would drop a precision-guided weapon onto the target to try to limit any collateral damage, because as Caleb said, trying to limit damage inside the city is very important as part of the strategy. But the A-10 can't move troops, can't move logistics, can't evacuate a wounded soldier or Marine, can't land SAW forces on raids, and can't land ground combat units. So Lawrence is absolutely correct that the A-10 provides an important augmentation to the AH-64s, but it can't do what a helicopter does.
Mm. Lawrence, thanks very much for your call. Let's get one from Hingham, Massachusetts, and Andrew. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to add an example. There's a book called The Bright Shining Lie. The author's name escapes me right now. But it's a tome about the history of Vietnam, and he describes one scene where a helicopter, early in the war, I can't remember the year, but a helicopter's flying, and a Viet Cong comes out and starts shooting his rifle directly over his head, and the pilot and the people on the helicopter start laughing that he looks like an idiot. But what he uses is an example of the beginning of them being trained on how to shoot down helicopters and how you have to lead them. You can't aim at the helicopter, but you aim ahead of them.
What do you take from that, Andrew?
Well, it was what he said was this is one of the turning points in the war where they started taking down the birds, and it was one of the biggest problems that we had. And so to say that this is a law of average thing now in Iraq seems like ignoring history a little bit.
Andrew, thanks for that. Caleb Sepp, here's the kind of native experience of, you know, Americans who have lived through a lot now and maybe read Neil Sheehan's book there, seeing this, and in the back of our minds we wonder, you know, can this work? IEDs on the roads, choppers coming down in the skies. We trust that the soldiers will go out and do whatever they're ordered, and they can go on foot. But do we get to some kind of point where whatever Congress does, it just gets too jammed up to function effectively in an already tough environment?
To go back to a question that you had asked me before, Tom, that I never quite got around to answering.
Mm-hmm.
Was the one of the previous callers had raised this about the political effect of this, and in the Soviet-Afghan war, the historical example, the Soviets were rocked back on their heels for several years while they were trying to adapt to the new techniques that the Mujahideen were using, but they did. They through major changes in tactics. Even their overall operations in the entire country and new technologies that they embedded in their helicopters and other aircraft, they were able to then continue operations. But the point would be that at that time the Russians had run out of political capital and found it that the only thing that they had left to do diplomatically was to withdraw from the country. So even though they were eventually countered, the Mujahideen use of these anti-aircraft systems bought them the time and extended the war long enough for them to gain that political advantage.
Mm. Robert Work, how do you see it? I mean, I think Americans are listening and watching very closely here. A lot have already made their decision on Iraq, and we saw a bunch of that in the November election, people wanting out. But others are still listening, saying, should we hang in? And effectiveness is a big issue. I mean, there's the issue of political support at home, but a lot of people are gauging their support on whether or not they think something can actually be done in the field. How big a crimp in U.S. effectiveness in Iraq could this kind of chopper loss prove to be?
Well, Tom, that's the critical question. I'd like to go to just to comment on something that Andrew said. He's exactly right. The last air assault, major air assault that we did in Vietnam was called Operation Lam Som 719, in which we did a huge air assault of South Vietnamese troops into Laos. And in a one-week period, primarily using small arms fire, anti-aircraft cannon, and machine guns, 100 helicopters were shot down and 400 were damaged
wow.
so that they couldn't fly. 500 in 1 week.
Wow.
So we've lost 6 in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The key question that you are asking is this the start of a major shift in enemy tactics?
Mm.
So I think what the coalition forces are doing is, okay, is this the law of averages? Is it as a result of more helicopters in the sky? Number two, were they shot down or was it a maintenance problem? It appears as though most of them are being shot down.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, how were they shot down? Were they shot down by small arm fire or shoulder-fired air missiles? Number four, what are the changes in our tactics to respond to that? What General Caldwell said,
mm-hmm.
changes to tactics, techniques, and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are the anticipated enemy counter responses? But more importantly, the final question, is this a broader shift of the insurgents towards guided weapons on the battlefield? Hezbollah was using guided anti-tank weapons against the Israelis in the most recent Lebanese war. They used anti-ship cruise missiles. If the enemy shifts to these type of guided weapons, it really will cause problems. And unfortunately, when you shoot down a helicopter, generally you lose 7 troops at a time rather than 1 or 2 in a Humvee.
Mm.
And this gets back to what William and David
mm-hmm.
and Caleb have said. This is a battle of wills and political will. And if it appears as though the enemy can deny us the skies and cause a lot of casualties, it could affect the overall way the Americans are fighting on the ground there and also the way the American people perceive the war.
Now, I'm just a poor civilian trying to keep up here, but you're talking now about guided weapons. I thought you said earlier that it appeared as though most of this was small arms fire, or did I misinterpret?
Well that's, I believe that the coalition forces are being very careful on I don't believe they have officially announced exactly how these birds were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
Anecdotal evidence seems to be that some combination of guided weapons and small arms fire have been used. But I believe that the coalition forces will be very careful in telling what's happening just to keep the enemy from knowing how we will respond to them.
Caleb Sepp, in Afghanistan, the U.S. role in getting guided missiles under Soviets was very important. If it turns out that it's guided weapons being used to bring down these choppers in Iraq, does the eye turn logically or for political reasons to Iran? Is Iran going to begin to be fingered here?
They could be, because they've had advisors operating in the country for several years. They have that kind of expertise resident in their military forces. It would make sense that they would it would accrue to their advantage to damage the Americans in this particular way, in any way that they could find, and this would be another vulnerability that they could exploit.
Let's go to Craig in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Craig, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I was in Kosovo as a journalist, the one thing you realize is the American military is so reliant on helicopters. If this becomes a big campaign, I can't see how the American military can survive, first of all. That's one point, without helicopters, because they use them for everything. Sort of like the L.A. Times reporter said, it's like taking a bus. One of the things I noticed, though, Blackhawks, Chinooks, Sea Knights, maybe one of the experts could address this. These carry a lot of troops. Wouldn't it be possible the Apaches are lethal killing machines to escort every time you have a dozen troops on a Sea Knight? Send an Apache escort with them. Rather than an A-10 gunship, which can cause a huge amount of damage in an urban area, Apaches can get in, get out. If you notice in the Iraq War, Apaches aren't the big target because they're so quick.
Mm-hmm.
They're very stealth-like. Wouldn't you send an escort of an Apache with a Sea Knight every time, or a Chinook?
Robert Work?
Yes, I think you would, and I think that's probably standard tactics. Except for, up to this point, because the threat has not been too high, you have seen individual transport helicopters moving very fast at low altitudes. If this became a major problem, you would probably have to think of escorting. And the A-10 is quite good in this role also. The A-10 is a good escort bird. The AH-64 is a good escort bird. They are there to suppress enemy fires that are being put to bear on the transport helicopters that carry the most troops. Mm. This is all about tactics and how you would respond.
Let's go to Greg in Saranac Lake, New York. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
Sir.
I served as an infantry squad leader in Samarra, Iraq in 2004. I don't have a lot of experience with helicopters, but I have two questions. Is there enough coordination between the unmanned drones, which we used a ton of in Samarra, and the helicopters? Could the drones fly closer because they're unmanned and coordinate with choppers that flew farther back? If there was a problem, the gunships would go in and address the problem. And two, has there been any study or does anyone know the statistics and proportions between this war and the first Gulf War and Vietnam between the total man-hours of choppers and missions and what we've lost? Is this an epidemic or is it just proportionate?
Good questions. Thanks, Greg. Caleb Sepp, what about drones versus choppers? Can they one supplement the other or take the other's place?
Well, I was in Samarra the year after the collar and looked very closely at the way drones were being used in coordination with all kinds of operations. And the short answer to his question is that, yes, all of these things are either being used or being experimented with to optimize all of those sources in protecting the helicopter fleet. But in terms of proportionality, again, and Robert was just addressing this.
The ratio of shoot downs to flight time.
Right. The scale of combat is very, very different from Vietnam. And in the war so far, up until this recent spate of shoot downs, in almost 4 years, there had been only 57 helicopters that had been lost to combat action, compared to as Robert so well described, 100 helicopters lost in Vietnam in a single operation. So the scale is completely different, and it makes it very difficult to compare.
We'll keep our perspective here. Terry's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a preacher, and I recently preached on David and Goliath, and I'm going to try to condense 10 minutes into 1 minute. But basically, we're Goliath, and the Iraqis are David, and David is always going to win because Goliath is always going to trust into their superior armaments, and they're not going to learn enough about the indigenous population to know what weapons the indigenous population has.
A lot of American soldiers out there right now, as we speak, doing their darndest, Terry.
I know, but we, as a country, didn't study Iraq to know what we were up against, and we put people out there in these machines, and we neglect the fact that very simple armaments can take us down.
There's a lesson from long ago, and with the preacher's perspective, Terry, thanks for the call. Our time is short. Robert Work, what about the David and Goliath lesson here? We've all been watching a lot of conflicts around the world. Very often, it has been underdogs victorious. Is it time to start thinking that way here or not?
Well, a regular war or insurgencies, they are typically the tactics of the weak against a Goliath. And the American forces have traditionally found these type of operations, both in Vietnam and in Iraq, very, very, very difficult because we do tend to emphasize high technology solutions. But this all-volunteer force that we have, I have to tell you that it is one of the most tactically flexible forces in history. As General Caldwell said, I guarantee you that there are smart lieutenants, majors, colonels, generals saying, how are we going to respond to this? It is a tough, tough challenge, but you can never underestimate the flexibility and ingenuity of the American soldier and Marine. It's just pretty awesome.
Mm. We wish them all luck in staying alive. At the same time, you hear the wheels turning, everybody's watching and thinking about exactly what this means. We really appreciate the close lesson in all this today. Robert Work at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in Washington, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
I will. Thank you, Tom.
And Caleb Sepp, retired Army Special Forces Colonel with the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Caleb Sepp, always great hearing from you. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Good talking with you, Tom. Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.